Is there anyone there? I was talking to a journalist just before this lecture, and with a twinkle in her eye, I think, she said to me, are you going to talk about UFOs? Are you going to talk about God? Well, it is, of course, the second of those possibilities that I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to discuss whether there are hints and indications that there is indeed the mind and purpose of God behind the order and history of the universe. As a Christian, I believe in God the Creator. And I don't, of course, interpret that belief as meaning as I look around the world, I'm going to see lots of things stamped, made by God. But it would be very surprising, I think, and rather disconcerting if there were no suggestions, no nudges or hints that there might be a God behind what is happening in the world. In other words, what I'm going to try and do this afternoon is to investigate with you a little bit together the possibility of natural theology. Now, natural theology you could define as being the attempt to learn something of God by the exercise of reason and the inspection of the world. In other words, from general human experience. I'm not this afternoon talking about theology of revelation. I'm not considering the possibility, which of course I believe, that God has acted through specific people and specific events to make the divine nature known. But is there a general indication of the divine presence in the world? And I think that the exercise of natural theology is a very natural one, and one that in fact has a long history. If you look at the Hebrew Bible, it seems to me that the wisdom writers of the Hebrew Bible are the natural theologians of their day. They don't spend much time talking about God's actions in sacred history. They don't refer very much to the deliverance from slavery in Egypt or the encounter with the divine presence on Mount Sinai. They simply look at the world, and they look at the world with a pretty cool look. And they say all sorts of things in a very cool sort of way, very matter-of-fact sort of way. Like a golden ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without understanding, is the sort of thing that the writers of Proverbs like to say. In Christian history, there have been two particularly vigorous periods of the flourishing of natural theology. One was the later Middle Ages that we associate particularly with the names of Anselm and Aquinas. And there the appeal was very much, really, to the exercise of reason. The late medievals were tremendously keen on logic and careful argument. And of course, what more astounding argument could there be than Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God? Anselm, you know the argument, there, how it goes. Anselm defines God as that than which no greater can be conceived. So, of course, you start to list the properties of this maximal being, obviously omnipotent, obviously omniscient. What about existence? Isn't it better to exist than not to exist? Therefore, God exists. It's a brilliant, clever argument, but there's something fishy about it, because Anselm has produced a divine rabbit out of a logical top hat, and that doesn't seem quite right. And I think it was Immanuel Kant, really, who showed us how the trick was done. The point is that there are true predicates that describe a being, like omniscience or omnipotence, but existence is not a predicate in that sense. Existence, to assert existence, is to say something else. It's to say that there is an instantiation of the being defined by the true predicates. And therefore, you can't use the property of existence in the way that Anselm tried to do. And of course, as you know, Thomas Aquinas never actually accepted Anselm's ontological argument. Thomas had his famous five ways of looking at the world, which suggested that behind it there was one whom all call God. But Anselm's arguments are of a pretty general character, except for that they refer to change in the world, and for example, and say that there must be some unchanging ground of the world's existence if it stays in being. Only the fifth way, which is a form of the aptness of living beings, is a real appeal to something connected with the way the world actually seems to be in its detail. But in the second great period of the flourishing of natural theology, which is the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, which we associate with names like that of Archdeacon Paley, that was an uninhibited appeal to looking at the way the world is. People have begun to study life, particularly through the microscope. They become aware of the extraordinary delicacy and complexity of life, and it seemed continuously to exhibit such delicate balance and such intricate design that the claim was there must be a divine, capital D, designer behind it all. And it all must have seemed pretty convincing until 1859, when, as you know, Darwin drew the rug from beneath that particular argument by showing how it was possible that the patient sifting and accumulation of small differences over long periods of time, in other words, an evolving history of natural selection, could produce what looked like the consequences of design without the direct intervention of a designer. And lots of argument raised about all that, but it was really, it sounded a sort of death knell, I think, for that sort of natural theology. And natural theology became very unpopular in theological circles, including, of course, Barthian circles. The possibility of knowing anything worthwhile about God from the exercise of reason and the general inspection of the world. Nevertheless, and now I get to the main point of what I want to say this afternoon, I believe that today we are actually living in a period of a third revival of natural theology. And interestingly enough, it is happening mainly at the hands of the scientists and not at the hands of the theologians. The theologians have not yet, it seems to me, with one or two honorable exceptions, have not yet recovered their nerve in this respect. But the new natural theology that I see happening, which I'm going to try, seems to me to be significantly different in character from its two striking predecessors. First of all, it is a not only a revived natural theology, but also a revised natural theology. It is more modest in its content. It doesn't talk, it doesn't use the language of proofs of God's existence. In fact, in 20th and 21st century thought, we've become very wary of the concept of proof. We've come to realize that there are very few things in the world that are worth knowing that can be established beyond a logical peradventure. Gödel there is the man who drew the rug. Gödel showed that any axiomatized mathematical system sufficiently complex to include the whole numbers would be a system whose completeness and consistency could not be established within the rules of its own argument. So that if mathematics in that sense is incomplete and not able to prove its own consistency, it seems very unlikely, clever man though Anselm was, that Anselm could prove the existence of God. So the new natural theology is more modest. It talks not about proofs, but about insights. It doesn't claim that you are stupid not to embrace theistic belief. But it does claim, and I'll try and substantiate this claim to some extent this afternoon, that you will understand more. You will be more intellectually satisfied in your approach to the complexity of reality if you view it from a theistic perspective than you would if you viewed it from an atheistic perspective. And the second characteristic that characterizes this revised natural theology is that it does not seek to rival science within science's own field, but to complement science. With hindsight, we can see that Paley's sort of arguments about design were an attempt, really, to rival science on science's turf, to provide scientific explanations for how it is the complexity of the world had arisen. Now, I think we have every reason to believe that scientifically statable questions will receive scientifically statable answers. Within its own domain, I don't think that science is in need of theological augmentation. But we also have every reason to believe that there are many questions that are both meaningful and necessary to ask, which are not scientific in their character. And therefore, if we are truly to understand the world, truly to gain the maximal degree of understanding of the world that is possible for us, we have to go beyond science. And interestingly enough, some of the questions that arise in that way are what one might call meta-questions arising from science. That's to say, they arise from our scientific experience, but because of their very character, they take us beyond science itself. They are meta-questions in that sense. And I want to spend some time this afternoon laying out for you a couple of meta-questions of that type. They will not be susceptible to scientific answer, but they seem to me to be questions that demand an answer about the world. And the first of those questions is an extremely simple one, one that is so simple that most of the time we never even stop to think about it or ask it. But I want to try and persuade you this afternoon that if you do stop and think about it, I hope you'll see that it is a question worth asking and worth seeking to answer. And it is simply this: why is it that science is possible at all? Why is it that we can understand the physical world and the biological world so profoundly? Well, you might say that's pretty obvious, and we've got to survive in the world. If we didn't understand the world in which we lived, then we wouldn't be able to stay around very long. If you couldn't make generalizations like it's a bad idea to step off the top of a high cliff, then you wouldn't be around for very long. You might be around a little bit longer in this part of Texas, or in fact my part of England, than you would be in a part of the world with high cliffs and so on, but we need in an obvious way to be able to understand the world and make sense of the world in everyday terms. But our ability to understand the world in which we live and our ability to explore it scientifically vastly exceeds anything that is either necessary for biological survival or, in my opinion, could conceivably be considered as some sort of fortunate spin-off from characteristics that are developed through evolutionary biological necessity. It's one thing to say you've got to figure out the high cliff is dangerous, but it's a totally different thing when somebody like Isaac Newton comes along and with an astonishing creative leap of the human imagination is able to see that the same force that makes the high cliff difficult is also the force that keeps the Earth, it's the moon in its orbit around the Earth and the Earth in its orbit around the Sun. To discover the beautiful law of universal inverse square law gravity, and in terms of that, to be able to understand the structure of the whole solar system. And of course, about 200 years after Newton, Einstein comes along, and through another great creative leap of the human imagination, discovers general relativity, which is the modern theory of gravity, which enabled Einstein not simply to explain the solar system, but to create the first truly scientific cosmology, to create an understanding of the whole universe itself. Our powers of understanding the world are very profound and greatly exceed anything that is necessary or simply entailed by everyday life. I don't know whether you're a Sherlock Holmes fan, but if you are, and I hope you are, you may remember that in The Study in Scarlet, Holmes and Watson meet for the first time. They meet over, I think, breakfast in a London hotel. And Holmes is pulling Watson's leg from the start, and he says to Watson, I can't remember apropos of what, he says, I don't know, does the Earth go around the Sun, or does the Sun go around the Earth? And the good doctor is horrified at this deplorable ignorance on the part of the great investigator. And Holmes simply says to him, what does it matter for my daily life as a detective? And of course it doesn't matter. But we know many things that we don't need for simply mundane necessity. And we are able to understand realms of experience that are totally different than the experience of the everyday. I worked in particle physics for 25 years. I was a quantum physicist. The quantum world is totally different from the world of every day. In the quantum world, as you know, if you don't know what something is, if you know what something is, you don't know what it's doing. If you know what it's doing, you don't know where it is. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in a nutshell. That world is totally different from the world of every day. It is totally unpicturable to us. It's cloudiness and its fitfulness, but it is not unintelligible to us. We can understand the quantum world. It's a remarkable fact that we can do it. And not only is it that a remarkable fact, but there's another remarkable fact, namely that it is mathematics. It's mathematics, which is the key to unlock the secrets of the physical universe. I'm here at Baylor partly to participate in a conference that's being organized here, and which I'll be speaking this evening, to celebrate the anniversary of the birth of a person who was the greatest British theoretical physicist of the 20th century, Paul Dirac. Not all of you perhaps will know his name. He was one of the founding figures of quantum theory and a very, very great man indeed. And he made his very great discoveries by the use of mathematics, by the relentless pursuit of beautiful equations. He had the conviction, a conviction that arose out of his own experience and the long history of theoretical physics, that when we look at the fundamental structure of the world, we find that the mathematics that describes it is always characterized by the unmistakable property of mathematical beauty. I don't know, not all of you perhaps will know about mathematical beauty. It's a rather rarefied form of aesthetic experience. But those of us who have it and speak the language can agree about it. It involves something like economy and elegance and what the mathematicians call deepness. By deepness, they mean very simple-looking things that have very profound and extensive consequences. And we found time and again in physics that it's only theories that have that quality of mathematical beauty that actually turn out to have that long-term fruitfulness that persuades us that they are verisimilitudinous descriptions of the physical world. In fact, Dirac once said, it is more important to have beauty in your equations than to have them fit experiment. Now, what did he mean by that? He obviously didn't mean that empirical adequacy is dispensable as far as physics is concerned. Nobody could possibly believe that. But what he meant was this. Suppose you've got an equation and you find it doesn't appear to fit experiment. Well, there are just some possible ways out of the dilemma. Almost certainly, you would have had to solve the equation in some sort of approximation, and maybe you just made the wrong approximation. You didn't get the right solution. That's quite possible. Or it's just possible the experiments may be wrong. We've known that happen more than once in the history of physics. But if your equations are ugly, there's no hope. They couldn't possibly be a theory. And Dirac made his big discoveries, and Einstein discovered general relativity through an 8-year search for a beautiful equation. And in the end, he found it on the 15th of November, the 18th of November, 1915. And I'm sure that when he found it, he knew he'd found it. It was so beautiful that it just had, as he said later on, it just had to be true. Now, when we use mathematics in that sort of way, as a technique of discovery, as the key to unlock the secrets of the physical world, something very strange is happening. Because you see, what's mathematics? Mathematics is abstract thought. Our mathematical friends sit in their studies, and out of their heads, they dream up the beautiful patterns of pure mathematics. If you're not a mathematician, just think of it as being a pattern-creating, pattern-analyzing subject. What I'm saying to you is that some of the most beautiful, wonderful, satisfying patterns that mathematicians can think of are found actually to occur in the structure of the physical world around us. So the universe in which we live is not only rationally transparent to us, it's rationally beautiful to us. That's what gives fundamental scientists the reward of all their weary labors. A word that is an indispensable word in a scientist's vocabulary is the word wonder. They don't write it in their papers when they submit them to the physical review. But when they talk to each other, it's a word that they do use. We are caught up and rewarded by the rational beauty of the world in which we live. And what are we to make of that? Surely the intelligibility of the world, its deep rational beauty, must be what the mathematicians, in their very modest way of thinking, would call non-trivial. Non-trivial is a mathematical word meaning highly significant. So is it just our luck? Why does the reason within our mathematical thoughts and the reason without the structure of the world fit together? Just a happy accident? Well, that's a meta question, you see. It comes out of our scientific experience that that's so, but science itself does not provide the explanation of why that should be so. Scientists as scientists are simply happy that it's the case and content to exploit the wonderful opportunities that it presents to them. But science itself doesn't explain it. But surely we shouldn't just shrug our shoulders and be so intellectually lazy as to say, well, gee, that's the way it happens to be, and a bit of good luck for you chaps who are good at maths. I want to know why maths works that way. Why Dirac's brother-in-law, who was somebody called Eugene Wigner, who was also a great physicist and won a Nobel Prize, once said, why is mathematics so unreasonably effective? Why does it fit the physical world? When you ask a question like that, that's a deep question, and it won't have a knockdown answer to it. But here's, to me, an intellectually satisfying answer, and to me, the most intellectually satisfying answer I know, namely this, that the reason within and the reason without fit together because, in fact, they have a common origin in the rationality of God the Creator, who is the ground both of my mental life and of the physical world, which I am a part. That's how I can use religious belief to make intelligible what otherwise seems fortuitous in terms of a purely scientific experience and explanation. You could summarize what I've been trying to say so far by saying that as physicists investigate the world, they find a world which in its rational beauty is shot through with signs of mind, and it is surely a worthwhile consideration to consider whether it may not be the capital M mind of the Creator that lies behind its wonderful order. I in fact believe that science is possible because the universe is a creation. And to use an ancient and powerful phrase, we are creatures made in the image of the Creator. So that's one meta question. It seems to me to be the basis for a modest but insightful revised natural theology. I want to ask a second meta question of a rather more particular kind. And it's this. Why is the universe so special? Now, scientists don't like things to be special. We like things, on the whole, to be general. That's the way our habits of thought. And our natural inclination is to think that the universe in which we live, well, it's just a sort of common or garden universe of the average type that you might get at the local universe shop, so to speak. Nothing special about the world in which we live. But the more we've come to understand the universe, the more we've come to see that isn't the case. You see, the universe had a long history, about 14 billion years, and it started extremely simple. Immediately following the Big Bang, the universe was an almost uniform, expanding ball of energy, which is just about the simplest physical system that you could possibly consider. One of the reasons why cosmologists talk with, I think, a certain amount of justified boldness about the very early universe is it is a very easy, simple system to think about. Now, that world that started extremely simple has, of course, after 14 billion years of unfolding and evolving history, become very rich and complex. With you and me, actually, the most complicated consequences of its history, at least, that are known to us. A friend of mine, Holmes Rolston, who writes about science religion here in the United States, says that when an astronomer looks through a telescope at some distant galaxy, he or she should remember that the most complex physical system that we've ever encountered in our exploration of the universe is 6 inches this side of the eyepiece, sitting in the skull of the astronomer. The human brain is far and away the most complicated physical system we've ever encountered. So the world has started simple, has become very rich and complicated, and that in itself might suggest there might be something going on in what is happening in cosmic history. But more than that, we've come to realize that though the development of life and the development of human beings took a long time, the universe was about 10 billion years old, as far as we know, when life first appeared in it, certainly here on Earth, and it's now about 14 billion years old, and it was only yesterday, in cosmic terms, that self-conscious life like human beings appeared on the scene. Though all that's taken a long time, there's a very real sense in which the universe was pregnant with the possibility of something, of the rich complexity, something like human life, from the very beginning. Because the development of life has only been possible, it turns out, because the laws of nature take a very particular and very finely tuned, one feels driven to say, form. In other words, it's not just any old world that can produce beings of our complexity. I'm not suggesting that Homo sapiens, with our five-fingered particularity, was built into the structure of the world from the start. There's obviously lots of contingent things about exactly how we are. But that self-conscious beings have evolved in the world does not seem to be just a lucky chance. It seems to have been built into the world from the very beginning. And I'm sure you know that insight, or rather that collection of scientific insights, is called the anthropic principle. That a world capable of producing anthropoi, as I say, not literally human beings, but beings of our complexity, is a very particular and special universe. It's a very, very surprising scientific discovery. And I'd like to just share with you a little bit about why we think that's, why I think that's the case. There are many arguments that lead us to it. I'd like to just illustrate them by choosing two of them. You see, you might say to me, how could you possibly know all that? After all, we've only got one universe to study. So how do we know what other universes would be like? Well, we scientific people, in our way, we're quite imaginative people. And though we can only directly study this universe, we have access through our imaginations, at least to universes that are like ours, not too terribly different from ours. And when we want to specify scientifically what a universe is like, we specify, as part of the grand plan of the universe, if you like, what are the laws of nature that will operate in that world? What are the fundamental forces that will control the process and history of that world? For example, in our universe, we've got gravity. But we haven't just got any old gravity. We've got a particular sort of gravity. We've got inverse square law gravity. And moreover, we've got gravity that has a particular intrinsic strength to it. If you're not a physicist, it might surprise you to learn that of all the fundamental forces of nature in our world, gravity is far and away the weakest of the fundamental forces of nature, immensely weak. That might seem a strange thought on the way down from the top of the high cliff. But in fact, the thing about gravity is it only comes in one kind. Nothing cancels it out. And so though each little bit of gravity, so to speak, is pretty small, there's a lot of it around, and that all adds up. And it's the adding up of all those small effects that produces the big effect that makes the high cliff dangerous. Other forces of nature come in various kinds. Another force of nature is electromagnetism. That's the force that holds matter together. The seats on which you're sitting are held together by electromagnetism. And in fact, you are held together by electromagnetism. Now, electromagnetism is a much, much, much stronger force than gravity, but as you all know, it comes in two kinds, positive and negative. And over distances, they tend to cancel each other out, so we're not directly aware of electromagnetism in the way that we are directly aware of gravity. And then there are other forces in nature that hold nuclei together and give the properties of nuclei. Those are the specifications of a particular universe. And we've come to realize that it's only because our universe is exactly the way it is, with exactly the specifications it has, exactly the strength of the forces that it has, that in fact the development of carbon-based life has been a possibility in its history. Let me give you an example of why we think that. Suppose I think about a universe that's almost exactly the same as ours. All the forces of nature are going to be exactly the same as ours, but with just one small change. I'm going to have a universe which gravity is a little bit different from the way it is in our world. It's going, in fact, to be stronger than it is in our world, and to make things definite and also to make the sums come out easy, I'll make gravity three times stronger than it is in our world. That's the only change. Everything else is going to be the same. Now, suppose you could persuade the Creator to make such a world for you, and suppose you had a few billion years to spare to watch its history, I don't know what you would guess, but I would have guessed that world would evolve its own form of life. I mean, obviously it wouldn't evolve Homo sapiens, it would evolve something different. Little green men, maybe. And actually, they would be little, because if gravity is stronger, it will be harder to grow tall in that world. And so I would expect the inhabitants of that world to be rather squat. But in fact, there would be no inhabitants in that world at all. That single change would have made its history boring and sterile. So what would have gone wrong? Well, what would have gone wrong would be this. When you're designing a universe, you have to be very careful about it. And one of the things you have to be most careful about is to get the stars right, because the stars have a really important role to play in the possible fruitful development of life in the universe. And one of those roles, there are several roles, but one of those roles is simply to supply the energy that will enable life to develop. Life has developed here on Earth. It has a sort of 3.5 to 4 billion year history. It's developed here on Earth because our local star, the Sun, has been shining more or less steadily, not quite, but more or less steadily, for about 5 billion years, providing the energy that's fueled the development of life here on Earth. Now, we know what makes stars burn in that steady, reliable way. We understand the behavior of stars pretty well. And at the end of the day, it turns out that the way they burn depends very sensitively on a delicate balance between two of the fundamental forces of nature. In fact, between gravity and electromagnetism. And if you change that balance, you change the way the stars shine. And because it depends upon that balance sensitively, quite a small change, quite a small change in the balance brings about quite a large change in the behavior of the stars. Now, by making gravity 3 times stronger, I would have produced a world in which stars burn very, very, very much more intensely than they do in our world. They would simply pour out energy. Stars in our world live, on average, for about 10 billion years. Our sun is about halfway through its life. But stars in that other world would only live for a few million years, and then they would burn themselves out, burn to a cinder. And that would just not be long enough to fuel the development of life on any suitable encircling planet. You need, actually, a few billion years for life to develop and complexify. The first 2 billion years of life here on Earth, we only had bacteria. It takes a while for life to complexify. So that world would be boring and sterile simply because it would be a world of burnt-out cinder stars long before anything interesting could happen. So you've got to be careful. And actually, the stars have another extraordinarily important role to play. The very early universe is very simple. I've already said that. And the very early universe, therefore, only does very simple things. In fact, it only produces the 2 simplest chemical elements, which are hydrogen and helium. About 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when the universe had cooled down so it was no longer a sort of cosmic nuclear reactor, the world was frozen out with a nuclear composition which was 3/4 hydrogen and 1/4 helium. Now, those 2 elements together have a very boring chemistry. You really can't do anything interesting with hydrogen and helium. You can only get something like life going by having a much richer collection of elements. In particular, the chemistry of life, actually life needs about 30 elements, but the most important is carbon. That's why we talk about carbon-based life. Carbon has this ability to form these enormously complex long-chain molecules that are the bases of life. So you won't get life going unless you have carbon. So where can you get carbon? You certainly don't make any carbon in the early universe. There's only one place in the whole universe where carbon is made. Carbon is made in the nuclear furnaces of the stars. Every atom of carbon in your body was once inside a star. We are people of stardust, made from the ashes of dead stars. Now, one of the great triumphs of second half of the 20th century astrophysics was to figure out how these elements, like carbon, and then there's oxygen and all the other ones, are made inside the stars. And one of the people who played an absolutely leading role in that was a senior colleague of mine in Cambridge called Fred Hoyle. And the people who were thinking about that, they just couldn't figure out how to do it. They couldn't see how to make carbon inside the stars. The problem was this, just a slight technical aside. To make carbon, you've got helium there. You've got the helium nucleus, which we usually call an alpha particle. To make carbon, you have to make 3 of them stick together. And that's very hard to do. You might think, well, okay, the way to do it is, first of all, you stick 2 together, and that makes beryllium, and then wait around for a bit, and a third one will come along and stick in, and you've got the carbon. Well, that would be a great idea, except the beryllium is unstable, and it doesn't stay around for very long. So you can't do it that way. The only way to do it is to do it directly, to get 3 of these things to stick together at one go. And that seemed just incredibly unlikely. And they did all the calculations. It didn't seem to work. So they were really sort of stuck. And then Fred suddenly had an idea. He saw that it would just be possible to make carbon in that direct way if there was a very special property of carbon, we call it a resonance, it's a strongly enhanced effect, that occurred in carbon and occurred at exactly the right energy. It had to be precise. You could say, Fred could see exactly what the energy had to be. So it had to be there. If it wasn't there, it wasn't any good. This is the fine-tuning again, you see. So he goes away and looks up the nuclear data tables and looks to see whether there is such a resonance in carbon, and there isn't in the tables. But Fred is so convinced that there must be this thing, he gets his friends, the Lauritsens, who are big experimentalists at Caltech, and he says, "You go and look. You've missed it. I'm sure there's a resonance sitting there." And remember, he could tell them exactly where to look. And they looked, and there it was. It was the most stunning scientific achievement. But also, of course, it raises the obvious question. Is it just a happy chance that the resonance happens to be there? See, where it is depends on, in a way that we can't actually calculate directly, but it depends clearly upon the details of nuclear forces. If they were a little bit different, it would be somewhere else, and then it wouldn't work. So again, you have this fundamental fine-tuning of the forces of nature. So what do you make of that? Well, Fred's always been against religion, but he was really bowled over by this coincidence. And he said in a Yorkshire accent, that it's, I'm afraid, beyond my powers to imitate, he said, "The universe is a put-up job." In other words, this can't be just an accident. This must have significance. There must be something behind all this. And because Fred doesn't like the word God, he used the word capital I intelligence to talk about it. So there it is. I could go on spinning these tales for a while, but I won't. We live in a world that seems very finely tuned to the possibility of life. And the obvious question then, that's a scientific statement that all my scientific friends would agree about it. When we start to disagree, of course, is to when we say, what do we make of that? When we ask the meta question, why is the universe so special? Why does it have this finely tuned character? Now, I've got another friend who thinks about these things. His name is John Leslie. He's a philosopher up in Canada. And he has written, I think, the best book about the anthropic principle, which is a book called Universes. And John Leslie is an interesting philosopher because he does his philosophy by telling stories. And that's nice for chaps like me who aren't trained in philosophy. We can understand a story. So he's a sort of parabolic philosopher. And this is one of the parables he tells. You are about to be executed. You are tied to the stake. Your eyes are bandaged, and the rifles of 10 highly trained marksmen are leveled at your chest. The officer gives the order to fire. The shots ring out. And you find you have survived. So what do? Do you shrug your shoulders and say, gee, that was a close one, as you walk away? I don't think so. So extraordinary an event surely calls for an explanation. Now, of course, if you hadn't survived, you couldn't look for an explanation. But given that you have survived, it does seem sensible to ask, why did it happen? And Leslie says there are really only two possible, logically sensible explanations of your good fortune. One of them is this. Maybe today there are many, many, many executions taking place. Even the best of marksmen occasionally miss, and you happen to be in the one where they all miss. If there are enough executions taking place today, and there would have to be a very large number, obviously, that's a possible explanation. But there's another explanation. Maybe there is only one execution which is scheduled for today, namely yours. But more was going on in that event than you were aware of. The marksmen were on your side, and they missed by design. Well, you see how that charming little tale translates into thinking about the fine-tuning of an anthropically fruitful universe. Of course, if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't be here to think about it. We're carbon-based life, and we have to be in a universe that's compatible with carbon-based life. But that is such a remarkable universe that it doesn't make sense simply to say, we're here because we're here. Next question. And there are just two possible kinds of explanation. Maybe there are just lots and lots and lots of different universes, all different from each other, all separate from each other, all with different laws of nature. And if there are enough of them, and again, there would have to be a colossally large number, and if there are enough of them, then in one of them, just by chance, the circumstances will be right for the development of carbon-based life, and that, of course, is the one that you and I live in because we are carbon-based life. That would be a many universes explanation. But there is another possibility, namely that there is just one universe, which is the way it is because there's more to it than has met the eye. It is not just any old world, but it is a creation that has been endowed by its creator with precisely the finely tuned laws and circumstances that have enabled it to have a fruitful history. So we have the two possibilities: many universes or a creation. And Leslie says, we don't know which to choose. It's six of one and half a dozen of the other. Both are metaphysical guesses. We have no scientific reason to believe in all these other universes beyond our powers to observe. We have no direct scientific reason for believing in the existence of a creator. So it's a sort of metaphysical guess, whichever way we go. Which way should we go? Leslie says we don't mind. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. And I think if we're simply thinking about the fine-tuning of the universe, I would tend to agree with Leslie that it is even-handed. But of course, assuming the ontologically prodigal assumption that there are all these multitudes of other universes, in my view, only does one piece of explanatory work. It explains, or explains away, the fruitfulness of this particular universe. The belief that there is a creator God seems to me to do a whole number of pieces of explanatory work. I've already suggested earlier this afternoon, about half an hour ago, that it explains the deep intelligibility and rational order of the world. It also, of course, explains that widespread human testimony to encounter with the sacred that we can interpret as truly an encounter with the presence of God. So it seems to me that interpreting the anthropic fruitfulness of the world theistically is part of a cumulative case for God, whilst interpreting it in terms of many universes is a one-shot explanation of a less intellectually satisfying character. So there we are. Those are a couple of examples of meta-questions. Why is the world science possible? Why is the world so deeply intelligible? Why is the world so finely tuned and fruitful? Which arise from science, seem to demand to be addressed, but go beyond science's power to do so, and in my view, receive coherent and intellectually satisfying, but not absolutely logically coercive, answers in terms of theistic belief, a ground for a modest but worth taking seriously natural theology. But before I finish and we have some sort of conversation, I want to just say a little bit about another aspect of the universe which seems perhaps to point us in the other direction. And that is, of course, what is undoubtedly, in my view, the greatest difficulty for theistic belief, the thing that holds more people back from belief in God than anything else, in my view, troubles those of us who are believers more than anything else, and it is, of course, the evil and suffering that is present in the world. I don't need to explain the difficulty to you. You all know about it. And I want particularly to think about natural evil, if you like, the disease and disaster that's present in the world. There is, of course, a great deal of human evil, moral evil, the chosen cruelties of humankind. We are familiar with the argument, it's not a wholly convincing argument, but it's not a wholly dismissive argument either, that is the necessary cost of the great good and gift of free will. But if human beings have free will, then they have the freedom to abuse that free will. I don't think that leaves me totally untroubled, but I think it's an argument that deserves to be taken with great seriousness. But what about disease and disaster? Earthquakes, diseases, they're not directly a human responsibility. They may be exacerbated by human moral evil. When people build schools or hospitals on earthquake fault lines because the land is cheap, then of course that can enhance the terrible consequences of an earthquake. But what about those things? Well, again, I'm not suggesting for a minute there is a one-line answer to it, and I think the deepest Christian answer is the answer that Bultmann expresses so wonderfully in his book, The Crucified God, that the Christian God, as we see from the cross of Christ, is not just a compassionate spectator of this strange, bitter, and suffering world, but has been a fellow participant in its suffering, as, if you like, God's arms are stretched upon the cross in the darkness of Calvary. But at a less profound level than that, science can give us a little bit of help with the problem of the existence of physical evil in the world. We live in a world that's an evolving world, a world that didn't come into being ready-made at a snap of the divine fingers, but came into being with a deep potentiality, which it was then, in my view, allowed to realize and to bring to birth, partly through its own creaturely exploration of those given, God-given possibilities. Almost as soon as the publication of The Origin of Species, Charles Kingsley, Church of England clergyman, coined the phrase that I think encapsulates the right theological way to think about an evolving world, that God did not bring into being a ready-made world, but has made a creation that can make itself. And that seems to me to be a greater good than a ready-made world. It seems to be the gift of the God of love, of some freedom to create creatures to be themselves and indeed to make themselves through the exploration of potentiality. If you agree that that's a great good, nevertheless, you have to acknowledge that it's a good that has a necessary and inescapable cost. The engine that has driven the long and fruitful, astonishing history, really, of biological evolution here on Earth has, of course, been genetic mutation. It is through germ cells mutating that new forms of life have come into being. But if that's going to be possible for germ cells in a non-magic world, and this world is not magic because God is not a magician, an arbitrary, capricious magician, in a non-magic world, it must also be possible not only for germ cells to mutate and produce new forms of life, but for somatic cells to mutate and become malignant. You can't have one without the other. The existence of cancer in this world, which is a deeply anguishing fact about the world, is not, however, a gratuitous fact about the world. It is the necessary cost, the shadow side, if you like, of a world allowed to make itself. Now, of course, you can argue whether that cost is worth paying. But nevertheless, science helps us. It's showing us that the fact there is malignancy in the world is not because the Creator is callous and doesn't care about it, or he's incompetent and didn't bother to do anything about it, but because it is intrinsically a necessary cost of a creation allowed to make itself. And at a certain level, I find that helpful. I don't suggest for a minute it removes the anguish, or the anger indeed, that we feel when we see, a young mother dying of cancer and leaving an orphan family, but it does have a mild help in that sense. You see, we all tend to feel that if we'd been in charge of creation, frankly, we would have done it better. We would have kept all the good things and thrown away the nasty things. But the more we scientifically understand the process of the world, the more we see that these things interlock, that the world is a sort of package deal, and you can't have one without the other. And I think that is just mildly helpful. So there we are. I think that we live in a time where there is a revival of natural theology, and that does encourage us to believe that there is indeed someone there, or someone spelt with a capital S, that the mind and purpose of God lies behind the order and fruitfulness of the world. I'm not for a minute saying that my atheist friends are stupid. Obviously, many of them are extremely clever and intelligent and truth-seeking people, actually. But I do think that they understand less and explain less than is possible for those of us who are religious believers. So thank you very much.